Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today it's with great pleasure that my guests are Mara Albrecht and Alke Jens. Mara and Alke are the editors of The Spatiality and Temporality of Urban Violence, Histories, Rhythms, and Raptures, published by the University of Manchester Press in 2023. This edited volume asks how the city, with its spatial and temporal configuration and its rhythms, produces and shapes violence, both in terms of the built environment and through particular urban social relations. The book builds on the insight that violence itself is a spatio-temporal practice with generative as well as destructive capacities, which create and transform urban space and time. By looking at the different ways in which the spatial and temporal configuration of cities produce and shape violence, the contributors contextualize the dynamics of urban violence and show how violence affects everyday urban spatial practices and rhythms. Violence may reconfigure spatialities and temporalities in cities in the long term, changing the physical and social space as well as the rhythms of a city. Memories and imaginations of violence are also inscribed in city space, often in several temporal layers, and can lead to new violence through politicized practices of commemoration. But before we delve into all of this, first things first, Mara and Alke, welcome.
Hello, Roberto. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us. Nice to be here.
Good. So thank you for being here today. And obviously the first question goes about who are you essentially? So can you tell us something about yourself? But I'm also interested to know about the origins of the book.
Okay, perhaps I start. My name is Mara Albrecht, and I'm currently a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of History at the University of Erfurt in Germany. And I work in the fields of Middle Eastern, transnational and spatial history. And my research focuses on violence, policing, political cultures, and commemoration in post-conflict societies. And in particular, I have worked on political cultures and memory in Lebanese history and on the spatiality and temporality of urban violence and colonial policing in Belfast and Jerusalem during the British Empire.
Yeah, I come from a completely different background. That's maybe also already telling something about the book. So I'm a sociologist by training, and I work in a small research institute in the southwest of Germany, in the Arnold Bergstrasse Institute, which is adjacent to the University of Freiburg. And I've worked quite a bit on state theory and security. I published a monograph last year on the coloniality of violence in the so-called war on drugs in Colombia and Mexico. It's called Selective Security. And so I've been dealing with these kind of questions about who experiences violence, how, and in who is targeted by violence, by whom, and so on. And I became interested a lot in urban conflict and in social relations beyond the urban, but sort of anchored within cities in the last few years. And I've worked on political practices and agency in insecure contexts in the urban. So that's a bit where I come from. And this is a really interdisciplinary book. And maybe I move right into the question where the book comes from. So I think it was in 2018 when we organized together with Jutta Bacconi and Kirsti Stuvoy, two colleagues from the UK and Norway, two panels at the ECPR conference, like the European Consortium for Political Research. And this were two panels that were dealing with questions of urban violence and space and time. And then together with Mara, we organized a workshop on the same topic that was called Histories and Rhythms of Violence. And that took place in Erfurt at the University of Erfurt and was supported by the Forum for the Study of the Global Condition there, and also by the Durham Global Security Institute. And most of the chapters that are now in the book, their very incipient versions or the very first drafts were presented at and discussed at that workshop. So that's where we took it. And we were really interested in temporal and spatial aspects of urban violence. And then the pandemic came and this all took quite a bit of time, but we're very happy it's out now and we hope it sparks some discussions.
Yeah, perhaps I may add that we also had another sponsor, the Erfurt Research Group on Spatiotemporality, which is also a group I'm associated with and also explains my background.
I want to ask something about urban violence itself. We're living in an age where we do have conflicts, which are, you know, mostly state kind of conflicts, Ukraine, Israel-Palestine, even though obviously we've not really two states involved, and we also have other crises around the world. But we also see the reemergence of urban violence, and just recently, as we're recording this podcast, we can see Haiti that is being involved into this mass development of urban violence, political urban violence. So I was wondering, perhaps if you can elaborate more on the question of, is it still worth looking at urban violence? Is still a concept that needs to be explained better, unpacked, studied? Is there, in other words, is there anything that we still don't know that deserves to be looked at?
I think urban violence is still a very important topic, and there's much more to learn about it. I mean, our book is based on the idea that there's an intrinsic connection between space, time, and violence in cities. And this connection is created and characterized by aspects such as the built environment and patterns of mobility, and also the symbolic imbuing of space with meaning. And Nilida Fukaro, for example, has pointed out that violence does not only occur in the city, but is off the city. And while violence is, of course, used also in rural context, cities have a number of characteristics that generate tensions and sometimes also lead to violence. And these include, of course, population density and heterogeneity and the proximity of different groups. And in particular, social divisions along social and ethno-national or religious lines can be expressed in urban space. For example, in the case of gated communities or the erection of walls and fences and barricades to separate people, and the homogenization of neighborhoods through forced displacement.
Yeah, I actually think there's lots to unpack still in the topic of urban violence. So, I mean, we probably don't offer a polished definition of urban violence either in the book. I'm not sure if that's even possible. But what we want to make clear is that the urban is not just a backdrop to violent interactions or something, but our understanding is more processual, right? It's based on the relations between inhabitants and on power relations within cities. And I mean, there's, on the one hand, you might think that, so a few years ago, maybe the discussion would have been different, right? That conflicts are now have moved from states to cities. So when we started this discussion about space-time in urban violence, it would have been different. I think now with the Ukraine conflict, probably mostly with that one, there's sort of a return to the imaginary of interstate conflicts. But I guess that this doesn't really tell us everything about the conflicts in the world. There's a lot of work actually now on the urbanization of conflicts and conflict studies, urban conflict studies, so to speak. So that attention has shifted more from states to cities, I think. And I think we look primarily at physical violence here, but our understanding of violence doesn't neglect the structural dimensions in their interconnectedness, right, with space and time. So I think there's still lots to do in that respect. And our book is certainly not something sort of, it doesn't end that discussion, but maybe only starts part of it.
And actually, before we talk about the various chapters, I have a few questions about terminology, definitions, and also a methodological approach. So I was wondering if you can just give us a sense of how various authors, including yourselves, have defined urban violence.
Yeah, as I said, so there is not a polished definition of what urban violence is, I think, but there is a way of seeing or of studying violence that connects the urban specifically to it. So the city isn't just the place where this happens, but there's specific imaginaries, for example, about cities that do shape how people interact. But so we have sort of these imaginaries of cities as the apex of modernity, for example, as hubs of global flows of capital. You know, there's all this aspiring to be global cities, but the reality of everyday lives by many people is very different from that, right? There's also a strong asymmetry of who experiences insecurity and violence in cities and who doesn't. So I think what we try to do with this panorama of different cases or different contexts that we work on, both historically and in terms of different regions, is to show the complexity of this and trying to draw in conceptually, on the conceptual level already, space and time into these practices.
So let me ask something about the concept of spatiotemporality. You already mentioned space and time, and I was wondering if you can elaborate about this idea. What is, this concept of spatiotemporality, particularly in relation to urban violence?
I think this is also the major aim of our book, that we to bring together the ideas of the spatiality and the temporality of violence, which is expressed in this term spatiotemporality and also space-time, which we use throughout the book. And while there are a number of studies on urban violence in relation to urban space and also a few studies focusing on the temporalities of violence, the two concepts have rarely been brought together. And this is a novel approach of our book. And in this sense, spatiotemporality is an approach to the study of urban violence and provides a new research perspective that combines elements that have so far only been studied separately. And we believe that there are several characteristics of urban violence that benefit from a combined spatial and temporal study. For example, spaces are constantly changed by historical actors over time, and urban violence has a catalytic effect on urban transformations. And also urban violence is often associated with specific places and dates or times in cities, like occurring during the night. And also the configuration of urban space and particular rhythms of a city shapes the practices of violence that are used by the historical actors. And we suggest that violence has a rhythm of its own, and this rhythm disrupts and alters the rhythms of a city. And of course, past violence remains physically and symbolically inscribed in a city at different scales and also in a different interlocked temporal layers.
Yeah, maybe when a few things that I would add is, so the perspective, I think, also allows us to go beyond quite conventional perspectives on what cities are violent, who is violent in cities, and so on. So, because I think we can't conflate violence with a specific subset of cities or historical conjunctures that we are now past, for example. But with this perspective, I think we are, as researchers, compelled to differentiate the binaries that might be present with like conventional speaking about urban violence. And we think that the spatial temporal perspective lets us focus on specific practices in relation to the built environment, but also connects the timing of violence and its memory, as Mara said, to the rhythms of the city, to its everyday life, patterns of mobility. You know, imagine people moving around every day in a specific rhythm, and then violent acts will change that, will disrupt these, can transform them in the long term as well. So the approach leads us to pose specific questions for the different chapters, for example. So how, in different contexts, violence transforms space and time in cities, so how might it disrupt these rhythms, but also how maybe spatial-temporal practices can change the way violence is employed or may themselves produce violence, right? And how are violent practices influenced by spatial aspects, by architectures, by things like public spaces or the way cities are set up and so on. I've been particularly fascinated by Lefebvre's rhythm analysis. So many people refer more to his work on space, but I think this is also quite interesting. So it includes the temporal aspects and the ways in which these spatial practices are repeat, for example. He doesn't focus on violence, but this is sort of a methodological tool to, like one possible tool to grasp how unequal social relations shape everyday practices in the city. And then you can actually link that to violence, I think.
And talking about methodology, you already mentioned earlier that this is a multidisciplinary, an interdisciplinary volume. And so I was wondering, given the fact that the contributors are all coming from different disciplines, history, sociology, anthropology, how this approach can actually help recent historical debates about urban violence?
Yeah, you are correct. I mean, the multi and interdisciplinary approach is really very, very central to the aim of our book, because we want to show that spatial temporality is not only an approach that can be applied in different disciplines, but that the discussion between these disciplines is beneficial for the study of urban violence. And as you know, there are many interdisciplinary books on urban violence, but they usually do not include historical studies. And one of the reasons for this, I believe, is the prevalence of the idea that violence in the past is fundamentally different from violence in the present. This has been expressed by scholars in both the social sciences and in history. For example, through the notion of the concept of the new wars. And in our book, we seek to counter this notion with case studies from the past and the present that show that the actors from the past and the present engage in comparable practices of violence. And another aim is to break down the supposed opposition between urban violence in the global north and south, which is also often prevalent in research on urban violence. And I think interdisciplinary approaches and the use of methods and theories from neighboring disciplines in historiographical research can be of great benefit, as I bring new impulses to established fields of research. So from the perspective of a historian, I would say they help us to pose questions in new ways and to find answers that would not be accessible without these theoretical notions and methodological tools. Okay, I mean, I can say a bit more about the historical chapters in the book and how important they could possibly be for current historical debate. So the chapters we have in our book, they focus mainly on the late 19th century and the interwar period. And the spatio-temporal approach adopted in these contributions brings new insights into debates about imperialism and nationalism, and also the global and local transformations in the wake of the Great War. And it does so by introducing new perspectives on the spatiality and temporality of violence in cities. For example, through the imposition of new time and space regimes by colonial powers, shaped by Orientalist conceptions of time and modernity, as you, Roberto, and I show in our chapters, or through revolutionary collective action in times of social upheaval, as Klaus Weinhauer shows, or through the establishment of new commemoration days, as Andreas Bolte explains in his chapter on the Chinese humiliation days in British Malaya and the Dutch East Indies. And I personally think that reading historical sources from a rhythm analytical perspective can also help us to understand how violence disrupted urban rhythms and created new rhythms and patterns of mobility during historical periods of conflict. And focusing on the spatial and temporal practices of violence, and this, I think, is important. This helps shift the perspective from its causes and consequences to the actual violent practices of the historical actors and their entanglement with urban space and rhythms. And it's precisely this praxeological approach that has, I believe, not yet been sufficiently utilized in historiographical studies of urban violence.
Yeah, and if I can add, I think one of the things that the book does is really to show that we should not really focus on the trigger. The trigger is just a moment, but it's not relevant, even though in general, particularly outside academia, everybody's interested in the trigger. How did it start? Mm-hmm. But the causes and the reasons are normally set aside, and then only later on in time they become important, where that should be really the focus from the very beginning. And I thought this is very important because, again, it really shows a bit of a difference in how sometimes we can lead the debate and show where the attention should be instead of just focusing on sort of a superficial aspect of urban violence. Mm-hmm. I want to start talking about the various parts and contribution. And so part one of the book is about changing forms of urban violence. And so Klaus Weinhauer looks at Hamburg in Germany and Seattle in America between 1916 and 1920. And I must say that for a lay person, this might look like a rather unusual comparison, two cities very different from each other. And certainly very far away from each other, but and yet they are both seaports and they are both developed cities. And the author argues that violence in this context is a crucial element of urban social order, which I found very interesting to consider violence and order together. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense of his contribution.
Yes, in his chapter, Klaus Weinhauer discusses how social movements attempted to change political systems through sometimes violent collective action in the final years and shortly after the end of the First World War. And he analyzes the social upheavals in Hamburg and Seattle by taking a close look at the specifically urban spatial and temporal practices of working class groups against the backdrop of transnational social fears of Bolshevism and revolution that was very prevalent in the middle classes. And he focuses on the establishment of new space and time regimes, which, so he argues, are often at the center of sometimes violent collective confrontations. Klaus strongly advocates to focus on the concrete practices of violence and to interpret them in their function as tools for establishing new forms of social order and as a form of communication. And I think Hamburg and Seattle are very interesting to compare because they are both major port cities, as you said, where the working class was in a radical mood at the time. But in Germany, we have an urban setting during a revolution that was brought about, or that brought a regime change, while in the US, we have a non-revolutionary setting that was nevertheless saturated with a complex imaginary of fears of an imminent revolution that could be triggered at any time. So in Hamburg, Klaus explores the struggle of various groups over establishing a legitimate monopoly of force in the young Weimar Republic, and how new security organizations were formed, such as the soldiers and workers' councils and citizen guard and paramilitary free corps units. And it is in this context that he explains that a new diffuse social movement of the working class developed. And they sought to challenge established space-time regimes through their collective actions, organized around public democracy and rooted in working-class neighborhoods and on the shop floor. And their collective actions, for example, included work stoppages, informal discussions group in public places, street protests, and of course strikes. And their goal was to establish a local order in their neighborhoods, to reclaim public space, and to achieve unrestricted mobility at all times. Public acts of physical violence were also used to communicate elements of the newly established space-time regimes to the public. And in Seattle, Klaus focuses on the general strike of 1919. And at the time, newspapers reported on the Russian Revolution and the revolution and other urban uprisings in Germany. And this created substantial fears of an uncontrollable revolution. And interestingly, in turn, that led all parties involved in the general strike to act very cautiously. And in order to avoid creating fears of a real revolution, many striking workers did not attempt to march in large numbers through the city streets and did not try to collectively reclaim public streets and places. And there was actually little physical violence, which was surprising given the history of violent labor conflicts in the United States. Klaus Weinhauer demonstrates that historiographical studies of collective action in cities benefit from the application of a spatio-temporal approach by shedding light on the actual urban practices of the historical actors. And he shows that they directed their sometimes violent collective actions toward political change by challenging established space-time regimes and creating new ones.
And after Germany and the United States, now let's move to India, because the book also looks at, it has a global approach, essentially. It's not just focusing on the Western world. And so the chapter of Shrey Kapoor looks at India in the 1960s. And I found this chapter extremely fascinating because, at least to me, it connects also with the current politics of India. And I was wondering if you can just give us an outline of the context and the argument made by Kapoor.
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I also find this chapter really, really, really interesting. And I really like how Shrey connects sort of this broader and over a long period of time, an analysis of different hegemonic projects and connects those to the actual spatial reconfigurations in Ahmedabad, in the city, right? So he analyzes how violent evictions of lower-caste Hindu and Muslim workers from the center of Ahmedabad have served in part to construct a Hindu identity, an exclusionary one, in terms of this Hindu nationalism as a long-term project. So we have, what we are left with are segregated resettlement sites at the margins of Ahmedabad that sort of, for their inhabitants at least, extend the violence of dispossession, of displacement. But this remains basically invisible to middle-class people that live more in the center of the city. So you were referring to the 1960s, I think. So on the one hand, we have this historical dynamic at the riverbed of the Sabarmati, the river there, where Muslim brokers were actually able to partially protect incoming settlers, so a lot of people that worked informally, from state coercion. Paradoxically, also because these Muslim workers were less able to secure jobs in cotton mills and so on, so they had to move into informal jobs. So some of them became intermediaries, for example, in the parallel land market. So they became sort of brokers for others, right? And it's played a quite important role in relating to the local state. But nonetheless, they were subject to both efforts of dispossession and also to floods. And the resettlement areas that some of them moved to replicated the divisions between Hindus and Muslims. There was also a lack of livelihoods, and there were cycles of violence and cascading violence that Shrey describes historically. So there were anti-Muslim riots, for example, in 1985 and again in the early 90s. So Muslims from across Ahmedabad began to move to one specific resettlement area that was already mainly Muslim and quite separate from the rest. So the separations between the different groups became sort of more institutionalized or stronger. And Shrey shows us how this segregated social order of the city is, while it's not quite complete by the end of the 90s, Hindu elites were still trying to employ a new riverside redevelopment. So there was a, once and again, these infrastructure redevelopment plans popped up. And at the end of the 1990s, it was, there was a new effort to redevelop these sites where people were actually living, right? And shortly after, in 2001, Modi, who we now all know, assumed the BJP in Gujarat, but he faced some isolation. And at the same time, a year later, in 2002, another cycle of violence started, mostly by Hindus against Muslims, homicides, selective massacres, and so on. And interestingly, the BJP's vote share increased precisely in the districts that had experienced the most intense violence. This also meant that the BJP faced criticism because this happened, so to speak, under their watch. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Modi experienced visa bans in the US and so on. But it's connected to the riverfront development project and to these resettlement areas people had moved to earlier, because Modi personally then reacted to criticism by really pushing for development projects, and the riverfront development project in Ahmedabad was one of them. So then a new cycle of dispossession starts, and people again are moved out to these resettlement areas. And Shrey sort of tries to show how this violence cascades over time, how it's connected to this overall overarching project, but he also shows how there's a temporal aspect again, because the violent acts have an afterlife. People then live in new areas, but not with the old communities. Resettlement doesn't take place regarding the existing community ties and so on. So both state coercion and Hindu nationalist violence converged, and they completely reworked spatial and temporal patterns. And I think he shows that really well.
Now, part two of the book looks at dynamics and practices of urban violence. And Alke, your chapter takes us to Buenaventura in 2017.
Yeah, thanks for that question. This is always the most difficult one to talk about your own contribution. But so what I try to do there is try and think Lefebvre's rhythm analysis in relation to violence and understand violence through this notion. I use the term of disruption to analyze the frictions that emerged between what I call infrastructural nodes of acceleration. It's a port city that I talk about, and I'll go into that in a minute. And the movements, social movements formed by inhabitants of that city and urban space. So we are talking about Buenaventura. This is Colombia's most important harbor on the Pacific. It used to be shaped very much by port workers. So this used to be an important place or an important labor force, unionized and so on. But there was partial privatization of the ports in Colombia, and that pushed many of them into informal labor. And now the vast majority of them, it's mostly Afro-Colombian population in the Pacific. And the vast majority of the city's population is now without actual jobs. So some get day-to-day contracts, but it's not what it was. So at the same time, it's one of the most violent cities in Colombia. You need to know where invisible borders are in town because you can't cross them. That's the fronteras invisibles is a notion coined by Colombian colleagues of mine. So this is both a city of violence and a global trade hub, and that makes it really interesting as a context to study urban violence. It's also deeply shaped by the Pacific, by the tide. So with neoliberalization, the port turnover has accelerated and the city rhythms have changed completely in the past 20 years. The port was somewhat decoupled from the city because of this change in who you use as labor and because of automation and so on. But also, according to media interviews with activists there, there's a rhythm of forced disappearances, then displacement, and then port expansion. So what they are saying, and I think we should take them seriously, is that there's an intensification of violent rhythms that takes place every time a new harbor project was planned. We can trace ebbs and flows of violence there in 2003, 2006, 7, 2011, then again 2013, 2014. And the patterns of violence also changed. So there were selective murders and massacres in the early 2000s. And so what the documents show is that it then changes to torture and forced disappearances more likely in the 2010s. So we have, this is the context, and I would say that violence here has a productive effect. It has shaped the everyday rhythms of people. People stay in their houses. They don't go out swimming anymore. They don't meet up on the shore. And what I look at specifically is how do people then navigate this and what do they do to counter that kind of violence? And there is, interestingly, and you would have to express a lot of respect towards these people, because in this very adverse context, people, inhabitants of Buenaventura in 2017 start a civic strike. So it's not so much the unionized workers or the former port workers, but it's inhabitants of the city. And they disrupt the port for 3 weeks straight. And with that, they have considerable leverage and they halted the trade flows. And through that, they were able to draw attention to the violent rhythms they were subject to. And I would say here with rhythm analysis, we can show both the effects that violence has, but also the effects that mobilization can have. So they disrupt the violent rhythms themselves and gain with that. I would say they gain at least to some extent, regain some agency.
Mara, our works cross path on the question of Jerusalem, which you discuss in relation, in fact, it's better saying in comparison with Belfast in Northern Ireland. And I was wondering if you can elaborate on the question of what you call spatiotemporal patterns in the riots in Belfast and Jerusalem during the British era. So for the historians of Palestine, we're talking about obviously mandatory Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As both our chapters show, British Mandate Jerusalem is a very instructive example of how colonial policies rapidly altered space and time in a city. And while I focus mainly on urban rhythms, your chapter very skillfully actually shows how British urban planning strategies transformed space and time in Jerusalem from shared to segregated in a very short time period. And you also describe how a new form of time regulation through public clocks became an essential part of the riots and the respective narratives of the groups about the unfolding of the riots. So my chapter comparatively examines how the numerous riots in Belfast in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, as well as in British Mandate Jerusalem, were triggered by radical changes in the spatio-temporal configuration of both cities. And in that time, both Belfast and Jerusalem underwent significant transformations that were initiated by imperial policies and changing perceptions of space and time. So in Belfast, for example, the rise of the British Empire as the principal imperial naval power led to a rapid process of industrialization and the creation of new working class neighborhoods and population shifts, and actually a very strong competition between Protestants and Catholics for jobs and housing. And a new industrial time regime was established in the city, clocking the daily rhythms of life according to the needs of industrial production in the shipyards, linen mills, and rope-making shops in Belfast. In Jerusalem, on the other hand, British Orientalist perceptions of time and religious identity shaped the urban planning policies. And they also introduced spatial and temporal divisions among the population that were not present in Ottoman times. So combined with Zionist immigration, the physical space of Jerusalem and its symbolic meaning were permanently altered. In addition, a new calendar emerged that included religious holidays and political commemorations designed to promote nationalist aspirations. And as Alke did in her chapter, I also use a rhythm analytical approach, and I focus on the practices of violence by the historical actors and how they were shaped according to the spatial makeup, and especially the daily rhythms of each city. In particular, I highlight how violence was synchronized with the annual calendar, as well as daily and weekly religious and everyday rhythms, like the shifts in the mills in Belfast. And I also show how violence disrupted these rhythms. And I have a really rich source material with which I work, mainly the reports by royal commissions of inquiry into the different riots, and very different archival sources, and also selected newspaper articles. And in my chapter, I argue that foundations for later episodes of violence in Belfast and Jerusalem were laid during the periods under investigation in my chapter, and specific spatio-temporal patterns of violence emerged that became part of the cultures of violence in both cities over time. For example, the practice of house demolitions in Belfast, where living space was highly contested. And this, for example, is a practice that you see again and again in the riots in Belfast, also in later episodes of violence or during the Troubles from 1969 to 1998. This was also a practice that was still used Or, for example, in Jerusalem, the desecration of holy places, which became symbols of national identity during that time. And in this sense, memories of past violence, I think, serve as a repository for the historical actors of later eras and provides them with a repertoire of violent practices that are shaped by the spatial characteristics and the urban rhythms of each city.
I would love to have a conversation, you know, about our sort of joint works here, but for the sake of time, we have to move forward because obviously there are so many questions. As you just mentioned, the issue of house demolitions, which obviously in Belfast ended, but for instance, in Jerusalem, that continued also under different administrations. Mm-hmm. So obviously, there's also a question of the legacy of that form of violence.
Yeah.
Now, I want to move to the last part of the book, which is about memories and representations of urban violence. And here, the work of Christine Mahdi looks at Beirut. Beirut, obviously, in history has been suffering urban violence in different parts of its own history for decades now. And she's discussing the question of the mnemonic palimpsest. In other words, how the scars of urban violence have impacted the urban fabric. And I was hoping you could summarize this chapter.
Yes, Christine Mahdi's chapter must be highlighted. I think it's a very important contribution to the book, as it is concerned with combined spatio-temporal markers of violence in a city. And she looks at the conflict-ridden modern history of Lebanon with its different phases of turmoil and conflict and war, including the 15 years of civil war between 1975 and 1990. And she explains that the war left tangible and intangible markers of violence in the urban space at different scales, from Greater Beirut to the core city, to its different districts and sectors and neighborhoods and streets and even buildings. And she also uses the notion of the palimpsest as an investigative tool to explain how recurring violence has been imprinted on Beirut in interlocking temporal layers. And what is also very interesting is that she chronologically maps violent events, places, and narratives. Christine argues in her chapter that violence resurfaces through collective memory and post-memory. This is a concept she borrowed from Marianne Hirsch. And she describes how these memories still affect the daily life of the Beirutis as they navigate through the city, including, and that's very interesting, the younger generation that was born after the war. And they have adapted their patterns of mobility according to the examples of the older generations. So Christine successfully links the markers of violence in Beirut spatially and temporally and investigates their continuing role from the past to the present. She shows how these markers are reflected in divisions and frontiers within the city and in urban dynamics, including population displacement, but also temporarily in memories and memorials that are also, of course, spatial markers and in forms of mobility. And she concludes by discussing how Beirutis could potentially disengage from the violence inscribed in the city in a number of ways, including overcoming intergenerational patterns of behavior, building new connections across community divides, for example, join cultural and civil society projects, for which she also has concrete examples in her chapter. And of course, by also providing neutral platforms for dialogue within the city.
So let's move now from Lebanon to Brazil. And this is another fascinating contribution. And I was fascinated by the discussion by Laige, where there is this kind of analysis of how about vigilantes. And now former president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, used them. And I must say that this is not something that is commonly known, you know, outside probably the spheres of academia, those who study in Brazil and Brazil itself. And so I was wondering if you can talk about this particular chapter, but also the question of vigilantes and how vigilantes are important in understanding the concept of urban violence.
Yeah, I'll try to do that. So Christian works on the discourses of urban violence or discourses about where it's located and the spatialization of these discourses. So it's also about representation. And the link with Bolsonaro, so Latin Americanists will know the discussions on vigilantes, but the link with Bolsonaro is that he never questioned the vigilante groups. So these are non-state groups that present themselves as anti-crime, anti-drug trafficking groups that protect certain neighborhoods. Often they're urban, they get together, and they are the ones that are sort of the watchdogs of the neighborhood. And ex-president Bolsonaro, he never sort of distanced himself from that, but Christian actually cites him in an early address, like from, I think it's from 2003, where Bolsonaro says something like, as long as the state doesn't have the courage to adopt the death penalty, these extermination groups, in my understanding, are welcome. So he's, I mean, this is in line with Bolsonaro's later discourses. So it's not really surprising. He was really supporting these groups. But what Christian can show is that these kind of discourses about such groups and about the spaces that they supposedly protect and the actors that they supposedly act against are, well, highly problematic, obviously. And they are also often not the only ones. So Christian is showing how they're increasingly, with the emergence of the vigilante groups in Rio de Janeiro, there is a spatialization of these discourses. So there's some places that are imagined as part of the bad people, and this is where the vigilante groups go in and commit murders, actually, we have to say, with the assumption that these are all part of the bad guys, right? The ones that will die or not. There's no consequences to be feared because of these discourses. So there's a way of presenting certain spaces within the city, or rather at its margins, that are sort of free to, where the vigilante groups are free to do their work because the state doesn't, supposedly. But obviously the reality is much more complex. And Christian poses the question, what about the communities in these marginalized places? What is what does the Catholic Church, for example, do based on liberation theology? So there's some of these, he traces how historically some of these communities get together, particularly under or with the help of the Catholic Church, and try to not succumb to fear in the way, in the wake of massacres that were committed, and sort of to not necessarily employ the same kinds of discourses that the vigilante groups do. And so he shows this by tracing how these groups, the Catholic Church groups, for example, react to the vigilante groups and so on. So this is very much about the, again, agency of people, because choosing what to believe and what to disregard and what, which spaces to go to and which not to go to, this is sort of defines what you are actually able to do, right? So it's important to know how people represent these spaces that are imagined as violent and as bad, inherently bad, and outside of the national community to know how they navigate violence.
Now, we essentially, throughout the book, travel continents and chronologies. And I was wondering if at the end of our conversation, you can draw some conclusion in relation to the question of rhythms and temporalities of urban violence.
Yeah, I think the book actually, or this perspective that we try to contribute, helps us compare different practices of violence and different places where violence occurs in new ways. It makes the analysis more complex, arguably. It also draws in different kinds of actors that might not actually be in place, right? That might not be in the cities themselves, but that are implicated in the violent practices, or that have shaped prior cycles of violence and so have some effect still on specific places. And I think it is also something that I find still quite worthwhile, and where I think there's a lot to unpack still in urban studies, is how these practices differ across spaces, but how they might also connect different spaces. For example, when we think of people that move from one place to the next because of violence, how does that affect both of these localities, for example? What would a spatial temporal perspective on internal displacement, for example, be? So I think there's still lots to do there, but it's a start of a discussion.
Yeah, I agree with Alke, and I think the book quite successfully demonstrates that using spatiotemporality as a tool for studying urban violence is a worthwhile endeavor that helps us to gain new perspectives and ask questions in new ways. So the space-time approach kind of functions as a common language that allows the chapters from different disciplines to talk to each other. And it also shows that the approach is applicable in different research contexts and with different research methodologies, such as ethnographic fieldwork or archival research and the interpretation of historical sources. And another thing I think we learned from working on this book is that not only a mapping of violence in urban space, but also a clocking of violence is necessary to fully understand how violence is intertwined with life in the city. And our approach has also shown that memory is an element that generates recurring conflicts in cities and has the potential to establish new rhythms of violence. Looking at temporal layers of memories of violence in the city helps us to move beyond this past, present, future tree section and offers a more complex and multidimensional understanding of time in conjunction with urban space.
I must say that I learned personally from working and reading the book itself how to use interdisciplinary approach and theories, particularly from anthropology and sociology, in my own work in order to understand the history of urban violence. And it was like fascinating to get rid of that kind of literature and then see that actually those theories, those analytical tools could be applied into historical models. And I know that this is like a not an easy relationship, you know, either way, even for anthropologists, sociologists, and political scientists to use when history and historical models into their own work. So mm-hmm. I think this is like a good way of approaching the subject and try to kind of play with each other understanding of urban violence. I have one final question, and very much about the nature of violence. And I was recently interviewing Benoît Chaland, who is a French scholar living in the United States and wrote a very compelling book about the question of violence in relation to the Arab Spring. And we both agreed in our interview that there are forms of violence which may be considered a positive force. And I was wondering, coming full circle, so going back to what we were talking at the beginning, if you can share your views about the nature and use of urban violence.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what we can say is violence is a productive force, right? It changes social relations. It can change the status quo. It can change what in the book we call spatio-temporal regimes, so the ways in which certain ways of acting in space and in time, or like in the everyday rhythms that you employ, they are often linked to certain institutionalizations. Mara mentioned the clockwork and so on for workers. Violence can change that, can disrupt that. And in that sense, it cannot actually be quite productive in fomenting change. I think we have to, as researchers, we have to contextualize. That's one of our tasks. And that doesn't mean neglecting the violence. It means putting it into perspective, into the before and after, and into a spatial context as well. And for me, this also means that we have to think about the after effects of violence, and these can, in the long run, obviously also be positive. So, yeah, I think that is something that we should be thinking about as researchers as well. But the other aspect that I think we are compelled to do as researchers is that we have to differentiate. And that means not conflating actors with their practices, not conflating violent acts with the people around. So, for example, what I just tried to... when I just try to recount Christian's text on a representation of violence and this of certain spaces as violent, I think this is something where we have to look behind that, right? We have to try and disentangle these kind of present representations.
Yeah, I very much agree with Alke here. I think it's clear, it's fundamental that violence is a social practice in human interaction. And historically, violence has enabled people to bring about important social and political changes. And although it is an instrument for creating and maintaining order, if you follow Heinrich Popitz, for example, it can also lead to regime change and the establishment of new and perhaps even more egalitarian forms of social order. And from this perspective, violence has not only destructive, but also a generative potential. And violence has, of course, played a central role in the history of mankind. It was crucial in the processes of state formation and nation building, and especially also in the creation of cities. And it continues to have an important impact on identity and group formation. So it will also continue to play a role in the future of mankind.
And maybe just to differentiate that again, so because I agree with Mara, but what I forgot to say is that obviously on the other hand, we definitely have to say as well that violence can also be used to inhibit change. So let's think of violence by dominant forces or state coercion is often employed to avoid change. And this is part of the analysis, I think, that we have to do.
These were Mara Albrecht and Alke Jens, editors of The Spatiality and Temporality of Urban Violence, Histories, Rhythms, and Ruptures, published by Manchester University Press in 2023. Mara, Alke, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.